forget. 3?
23. I'll be 24 this year.
So you're only 2 years. I'm 25. I just turned 25.
That's right. You were a senior and I was a sophomore.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I remember now. My guest today is Hunter Wilson. He's a good buddy of mine, has been for a very long time. We've drummed together quite a bit. He is a member of his group, the Third Coast Roots. He's a band based out of Houston, Texas. Would you say it's solely reggae, or would you call it reggae dub? What would you call it?
Man, we stumble on this all the time.
Yeah.
We've kind of came up with this new term that we call future roots.
Okay.
And it's basically, we're just trying to be as modern and contemporary with the times, and then obviously bring elements from the roots of the genre itself. So like reggae and rock and alternative, and you know, just blending the multiple genres together.
Yeah.
So we get asked, it's like rock reggae technically.
Yeah.
So
how long has the group been together?
As of this November, it'll be 3 years. So we're about 2.5 years right now.
Oh, yeah. So right in the, still kind of the early stages, but I mean, we were talking about a lot before we started recording, but you've built somewhat of a following and it's just going to keep growing and growing. So how long do you think it took to really grow that following up until this point? I mean, did it start happening recently? Did it happen within the first year, second year? What do you think?
I feel like it's, you know, it's definitely steady on the incline, which is, you know, we're thankful for that. But I think it comes in waves. So, you know, we started off, you know, just not really knowing what to expect, and then just putting our all into what we do. And then we started seeing a lot of people, you know, joining us along for the ride, and it was cool. And then it just, you know, over time just built and built and built. So I mean, it's just it's one of those things that you just got to stay at it, and you know, you'll, if you're not seeing progress, then you're doing something wrong, you know.
In a sense, like, you kind of take your passion for, I guess originally your passion was just drums, right? I mean, like growing up, or was it just music overall? Or
yeah, I mean, I've always been a huge music lover growing up as a kid. I mean, it's just been something that's, you know, embedded inside me. I think that it was about the time that we were in Drumline together that I started like really getting inspired by like production and, man, what's that sound?
Yeah.
How do they get that sound? What is that? Why is this over here to the left and then this is coming in over to the right? I started really like listening deep. And, you know, when I graduated high school, I'd actually moved to Colorado to do audio production at a place called The Recording Connection.
I actually didn't know that. I thought you just went, just, you know.
Yeah, just bailed on everybody. Yeah. No, I moved out there. I paid the flat rate for the, you know, the trade school at the Recording Connection for audio engineering and production and stuff. And it was like, it was real cool. I didn't really know what to expect. I mean, I was 17. Mm-hmm. It was one-on-one.
That's young.
Yeah, I was young. I didn't even, you know, I didn't know anything. I didn't know where babies came from. but it was one-on-one with a studio owner that, you know, obviously was successful in that city. So I wanted to move to Colorado Springs because I loved Colorado and just being in the mountains, and, you know, I just wanted to get away and just go for it. So, and then I found that opportunity and I was like, man, this guy, you know, he's worked with these many people and they're all super successful. And it was just be real cool to get a hold of, you know, what's going on. And, it was one-on-one in his studio, and then it was like online, you know, lessons and stuff. And like, I should have stuck, you know, with it a little harder at the time, but, you know, I was super young.
Yeah, young.
Life happens and, you know, stuff takes over, but it's just, you know, the way it goes. So, but ever since then, I've kind of had like this just passion for sound, you know what I mean? Just all
everything. Controlling sound.
Yeah, just everything about sound and, you know, production and audio stuff is definitely, I've turned into like an audio nerd over the time.
Well, so have I recently. We talked about that a little bit, just like the YouTube university I've dove into in the past 2.5 months of just like, okay, I learned how to play all these instruments. How do I record them and how do I make them sound good?
Right.
Or how do I get inspiration from what I'm listening to? And so you moved to Colorado. You are starting this. How long were you in Colorado altogether?
I want to say about a year and a half.
Okay.
I spent about a year and a half in Colorado Springs. And then towards the end, you know, I started crashing on buddies' couches and stuff. Yeah. So, but yeah, and then I just decided, you know, like, man, everything I've ever known is back in Texas. So moved back to Texas, was staying at Clear Lake for a while. And that's honestly, not going to lie, I put music in general on a big hiatus just because I went through just trying to figure out, like, what am I going to do? You know what I mean?
So, yeah, what's my kind of purpose? For sure. Yeah.
And I'm sure everyone still has those questions. I mean, every day. So everyone's
some people haven't figured out. Some people never figured out. Some people like try to figure out and they just take a little bit longer.
No, for sure.
How long was that hiatus?
Let's see. I want to say it was probably about a year.
Mm-hmm.
About a year. I had got a job in Baytown working as a security officer.
I didn't know that.
I've lived many lives, but yeah, I had a job in Baytown as a security officer, and I went and got my, you know, concealed license, and I was just, you know,
that's about as Texas as it gets.
And it was actually during Harvey.
Okay, it's 2017.
So this was during Harvey.
Yeah,
and that's about right, because I've been back about 3 years now, or 3.5 ish. Mm-hmm. So Harvey hit, and all these cars flooded. And they had these lots where they needed to be patrolled because there's all these cars and people were going to steal them or, you know, whatever, take stuff out of them.
Yeah.
So we patrolled those lots and I worked there for a while, man. And I didn't have a life.
Anything crazy happen?
There was some crazy incidents. That, yeah. Honestly, I didn't say anything. I saw people. I was like, you know what? Do your thing. I'm not going to say a word. Like, don't mess with me. They pay me by the hour. Peace out. Like,
yeah. I want to live an extra hour.
So yeah. Do your thing. I didn't see you. You know what I mean? So. There's a lot of people, honestly, it was pretty chill. They had people patrolling on carts and stuff.
Yeah.
And so we actually, all the carts had keys in them because they were still getting claimed by insurance, you know?
Yeah.
And we would just kind of go just turn them on and get the AC or the heat, you know, depending on the time of the year and just hang out in that nice, Denali.
Yeah.
You know?
The luxury stuff. Yeah,
the luxury, lean it back because it was kind of funny because a lot of people were actually selling your, you know, like it was like insurance, like fraud kind of, like, you know, like the cars weren't really totaled.
Oh, okay.
But they were like claiming them totaled to get some money.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that going on because, I mean, the cars started, you know, we were starting those cars. Good. Yeah. Cars were good. But so I was working out there for a while, man. And then this is actually where all this kind of sprouted. So I was working that job and I had just, me and Marissa started hanging out and Jayton had hit me up and Jayton is actually the lead singer of my band, Third Coast Roots. He's the male vocalist. He and I have grown up together. I mean, I've known him for about 8 years and we used to play music when I was in high school, you know, just a good guy to kind of jam with. Never, you know, really found many people to, you know, jam live music with back in the day.
I found that issue as well. Like, just nobody was ever...
It's hard to find people that are just, one, talented, two, committed, and, like, three, willing to, like, hang out and, you know, just make some good music.
Yeah, exactly.
And he was just super passionate. He's older than me. He's, like, 7 years older than me. So, it was definitely, you know, like, I didn't, you know, really think much of it at the time, but I was young. I was hanging out with this guy. I was like, you know, playing music with him and stuff, but we started making some cool stuff and like making it work. And it was fun. And then obviously this was before I moved to Colorado, but he had hit me up one night and he was like, hey, I got this acoustic gig over in Seabrook. I need some percussion or like a drummer or whatever. And Marissa was like, you should do it, you know? And I was like, yeah, I mean, you know, Why not? Moved back to Colorado from Colorado and I was just kind of hanging out. So I was like, let's do it. Hang out. So I did like the Cajon vibe and some bongos and just kind of mic'd them, but yeah, it was cool. So that was kind of like the kickstart. He was like, yo, like, you know, we could really do something with this, you know?
Yeah. And you got bitten by the bug again, I'm guessing. Cause like you play that one performance after a while and you're like, oh man, this is part of the reason why I do this. You know what I'm saying?
For sure. It was definitely one of those like, it just sparked the fire, you know? And it was just like, man. And I remember actually Jayton and his wife still kind of joke around with me about this because I was like, not really committed. You know, I was like, yeah, I'll play this gig. Yeah, fuck it. Like, whatever. Yeah. Oops, sorry. Excuse my language.
No, you're good. You're good.
So, like, I was just like, yeah, you know, I'll do this gig. It's whatever. But, like, I'm not really available. You know, like, I was working that job. I was just like, you know, I don't have much time. Whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, then I was like, that fire was sparked, and I started making that time and, like, forcing myself. Like, I was working 80-hour weeks, man. Like, it was intense. I had to really, like, discipline myself to put that time to make things happen or whatever.
And be efficient with your time.
And be efficient. And, like, I remember this was kind of whenever, like, social media was, like, really booming. I mean, it's been booming for the past 8 years, you know, I mean, even from, like, MySpace and stuff. But Instagram had came out, you know, what, in 2010, and it, like, it reached its, like, peak in, like, 2015. And, like, you know, people were just building brands off of Instagram and stuff like that. And, like,
monumental brands. Yeah. Like,
I mean, yeah.
Influencers had just, like, cracked the code.
Yeah.
Almost.
And it was crazy, man. And, like, that's what really grabbed me. I was like, man, these bands, like, they're just making music. And, like, they got families and, like, houses. And, you know, they're successful. And they, you know, they get to tour 3 months of the year and just travel and... You know, I was like, man, these guys are making a living off of it.
Yeah.
And I was at the same time where I'm like, what am I going to do for a living? You know? So I'm like, dude, this is it. So, like, I put 99.9% of my time into, you know, building that brand and, like, building the Instagram and the Facebook and the social media. And we just started capitalizing on social media as much as we could. And that's the biggest advice I can give, like, any band that's trying to reach an audience, you know.
It's right there for you.
Well, it's free.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the main thing. It's free publicity.
Don't have to hire a booker or anything. You know, don't have to hire a company to make advertisements or anything like that. It's, you can do your own.
For right sure. There. So we kind of, you know, built an audience on Facebook and stuff. And then we...
And this is just you and Jayton at the time, or had the band already been started?
Well, so actually, you know, we had played that gig or whatever. He had actually been working with our current bassist, Liam.
Mm-hmm.
He lived in San Marcos, and Jayton had found him, I believe, like, through one of those musician apps. You know, it's like people looking for bands.
Like Jamcard or something like that.
Some band app like that. I'm not sure. But Jayton, you know, as always, just looking for a good guy to jam with, play some music. So he found Liam, and Liam had kind of been in the scene locally playing with reggae bands around, you know, at the time. And so he's like, oh, yeah, let's jam, you know. Before I had actually played that gig, he had actually done some gigs with Liam, you know, as, like, bass and acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
You know, acoustic gigs and stuff.
That's cool.
And that's how he met him. He just couldn't, make it down the day that I filled in and, you know, play that gig with him. But so that's how Jayton met Liam. And I was talking to Marissa at the time, and, like, you know, we were just all like, dude, she was in a rock band, and, like, she was killing it. I told her, I was like, man, you got to get that vibe going and just, you know, you could be a part of this, you know?
Yeah.
And she jumped up on stage one time. We were jamming at somewhere in Seabrook and played this gig, and it went well. And it was like that moment, Jayton was like, yo, this is, like, you're in, like, let's do it.
It's funny how stuff like that works, because we were talking before about the reggae band I played in Louisiana. That's how I got that gig, was I was filling in for a band that was coming through town. I used to do that a lot. I used to like be the filling guy of town, of like, it was me and a couple other people that, like, if a band was coming through town and, like, they had an issue, like they had their drummer couldn't make the gig or something, or they had, in this case, drop off their drummer in Baton Rouge to get kidney dialysis. I don't know. It was a crazy story. So I'm playing for this.
It's always the drummers.
It's always drummers. Yeah. The kidney issues. He was left in Baton Rouge, and they were on their way to Lake Charles, which is like 2 hours from there, and they called the venue and was like, we need a drummer. And my buddy couldn't do it, my other buddy couldn't do it, so they threw the gig my way. And of course, it was one of those things of like, all right, I don't really want to do that because it's a lot of stuff could go wrong, but I feel like playing tonight, so why not? New Orleans funk band. I'm just kind of like playing funk beats, matching what the bassist is doing. Bass is really good. These are really good New Orleans musicians. Shout out to the band Ugly out of New Orleans. They're really good. But Energy was opening up for that band.
Okay.
And so they stayed and watched us, and they saw me play, and they fired their drummer on the spot and hired me.
Ouch.
And so that was a weird situation to be in, because I ended up being friends with the drummer that they yeah. fired. But that is just weird how those situations work out like that. And I ended right. up being with the band for a year. It was a great time. Played a lot of gigs with them, and learned how to really lock in with a group like that. It was like a 7-piece band.
No, for sure.
And they had a horn section, and they had, you know, 2 guitarists, 2 vocals, you know, all who also sang, and they also had a bassist who knew what he was doing, and a keyboardist who was, well, a keyboardist was actually one who helped me start my podcast, Wesley. But yeah, man, it's just weird how those things just kind of all the stars align for that one moment, and like you end up meeting friends
right.
that you make music with for life sometimes, you know what I'm saying?
No, for sure. Yeah, and that's basically it. What happened is, you know, me and Jayton had known each other, and it was just kind of like let's revisit this,
right.
you know, and we revisited it whenever we were more mature and more experienced and more dedicated, you know, and also it's all about timing,
mm-hmm.
you know, like I think we were all kind of at a, like, what are we going to do time? And so, you know, I'm not saying that we're living on, you know, gold right now, because I'm, you know, definitely not, but we've definitely just kind of took it, you know, for what it was, and just put all of our, you know, everything we've got into it, and just always worked at it, and still work at it, you know, very hard, which, you know, we've got an album we're wrapping up and getting ready to, you know, release here pretty soon. So definitely just evolving with the sound, and it's definitely a pleasure to play alongside these guys.
But it's always going to evolve too, you know what I'm saying? So it's almost like, you know, when I met you, I met you when we both lived in the same neighborhood, I think. I can't right. remember exactly when it was. It was before we got to high school, I think, but you were the word around town was like you were talented. Like you were a naturally gifted player, and I think you did a YouTube video or something of like a Devil Wears Prada song, and we all watched and like, man, that kid can drum. The kid can drum, and you learned everything by ear, and which was even more impressive. So it was like, you know, you took this little skater Hunter Wilson kid, who wore the checkered Vans and the all black, and well, you weren't all black,
pants
yeah, the skinny pants and the, and then you took that kid, and you know, we. A line, and we're playing together in the drum line.
Yeah.
Different situation, but we also developed our hands there.
Yeah.
So you took that and then you applied it to the drum set, and now you're playing. I just listened to some of the stuff you've recorded. Like now you're throwing in intricate fills, you're throwing in fills within the groove, you're staying solid in the pocket and stuff Thanks. Like that. Yeah. So when did you start drumming is my question.
Man. I believe when I heard that song by Franz Ferdinand called Take Me Out,
yeah.
and I heard that hi-hat groove, and I was like, and it was just like, man, like that's dope.
Yeah.
I want to play that. And like, as a kid growing up, it's crazy. Like now that I do play the drums, like my mom used to tell me, like growing up, I would be banging on everything. Mm. And I've kind of been a pretty, hyper child growing up, and I was just always causing a freaking ruckus and banging on stuff and playing with pans and pots and toys, turning them over and banging on them. And
yeah,
you know, my mom was always like, oh, he's gonna be a drummer one day.
Yeah.
And then they bought me a drum set, and then like I broke it, and like, yeah, this isn't for me, whatever. And then like in like I want to say 4th or 5th grade, I got like a drum, like a first act drum kit, you
yeah.
know, and I was like, this
the
is
Walmart kit,
yes, the $200 drum kit,
yeah.
this is it. And I bought like you know, like one of those like lesson books and like a DVD or whatever, you get them at like Guitar Center or whatever.
Yeah.
I was like watching it, and I was like, man, this is boring. And like I got my mom to like, actually my grandmother and my grandfather, they signed me up for like a couple months of drum lessons, and I was like, man, this is, you know, that's when I first started playing the drums. And like, I just remember walking in and be like, I want to play this song.
Yeah.
Like, you hear this song, like, I want to play this song.
Who taught you?
This guy named Ross. he used to work at H&H, but then he like started doing it out of his house.
Okay.
But, you know, he kind of just taught me like a lot of the foundational stuff, you know, and then like, obviously this was fifth grade. So I rolled into sixth grade where we started doing, you know, like percussion in school. And
yeah.
I just, you know, kind of stuck at the drums and, you know, just really, I took lessons from him. I remember it slowed down for a while due to like it being expensive and stuff and kind of got into some trouble growing up. So like they kind of took that away from me. So, right. But, it was one thing that definitely like, kept me sane.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my family kind of noticed that.
It's a good escape.
Right. They put me in that because they were like, all right, keep him out of trouble. Let's put him in this freaking lesson. You know what I mean? So,
I'll pay the $60.
You know what I mean? Yeah. It turned into one of those things. But then I started really liking it. And they'd take it away from me when I got in trouble, you know, whatever. And
like, dang, I gotta straighten up. I got to play drums. Yeah.
So, I mean, and then like I just kind of, you know, life happens. So you don't stick with it forever. But I think I want to say I took lessons for 2 or 3 years. And then.
Yeah.
Drumline happened, which I have mixed feelings about Drumline.
Of course, yeah.
Based on...
I do as well, believe it or not.
My drumming and stuff. I think it definitely hurt my kit playing
mm-hmm.
In a few ways, but it definitely taught me a lot. And as I've stepped away from Drumline and not doing all the strict rudimental stuff, like being able to be more relaxed for the past 6 years or so... It's been a good way to like build back that like kit style. You know what I mean?
Cause yeah.
like I get if people are going to go march and, you know, do the drumline route, definitely stick with that if that's your end goal, you know, but that I didn't want to do that.
Right.
So like at the time it was just drumming to me, you know, and that sounded awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, yeah, more as drumming, long as let's do it. Yeah.
As long as you had sticks in your hand and like you were doing something.
Banging drums and playing rudiments and shit. It was dope.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, like, it definitely felt better on the kit. I always loved the kit more.
It's what we both started on.
Yeah.
So, like, it's almost like a home...
Right, it's home base.
Yeah, home base.
Know? So...
I think we also were taught incorrectly, looking back on it.
Oh, for sure.
We were taught incorrectly by a certain person that, you know, we both had issues with. And when I went to college, I had to be... My technique had to be torn down.
Right.
And rebuilt.
Rebuilt, yep.
By who is now my mentor. And that was upsetting because we spent so much time in rehearsals and in competition. Yeah, exactly. You know, and it was frustrating because we were taught incorrectly of like, we were always taught to play through the drum. And what that means is like play really, really tight. And eventually that's going to lead to injury. It's going to lead to bad habits that are really tough to break.
Yep.
And that, as a music major in college, as a percussion major, I had to rebuild my hands.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't able to play anything.
Right.
I got to college drumline, and they were like, okay, relax. And I was super tight. We were taught the opposite way of what my teacher's philosophy was. So, if, in that case, it gave me a little bad taste in my mouth about our high school experience just because... Yeah. Of the lack of, I guess, attention to what we were being taught in those rehearsals separate from everybody else. So I can understand your frustration with it. I had to regain my love for it. I'm not even gonna lie, going into college, I was like, for one thing, I had to do it. And we had such a bad time with instructors, well, particularly one, that I was like, man, I just don't feel like dealing with the marching thing. If I could not do it and just work on my drum set playing or my keyboard percussion playing or concert snare drum, like I'm good. But the philosophy that my teacher put into the marching thing was more versatile and way more relaxed and applicable to everything as opposed to like, this is a separate thing, this is a separate thing.
Right.
Instead, we can make them more versatile and make them work together.
For sure.
And so I really had to regain my love for it.
For sure.
Because I had
Because it put you through hell.
It did. It's such a bad start taste from
stage one.
Yeah. It had to start me from, dude, I mean, like, I'm telling you, like, rebuild everything.
No, for sure.
How to hold the stick. I mean, I hadn't learned how to hold the stick in, since, like, 7 years. So 4 years of high school, 3 years of, you know, middle school, and like you get to sixth grade and they're like, all right, you pinch here and then you wrap your fingers around and you're like, cool. And then we get instructed the way we did, and you forget about that. And we're death gripping. We're not letting the stick bounce.
Yeah.
We're having to work way too hard.
Breaking sticks.
Breaking sticks. We thought breaking sticks was a good thing. Yeah. I haven't broken a stick. I don't think I broke a single stick in college.
I break a lot of sticks, but yeah. Mainly it's just from adrenaline.
Right, right.
You know.
Well, you're playing in a playing in a
venue setting is
exactly,
you know, you overplay.
There's way more energy in that. Well, there's also different kinds of energy with
for sure. And there's just nothing I love more than just being on the kit in front of people and just at the energy. It's almost like you reap off of their energy.
Yeah.
Like you know what I'm saying? Like you receive their energy and then it doubles your energy and then
yeah,
you know. So I definitely overplay sometimes. Sometimes I'm pretty controlled.
Well, that's it's okay though because.
Right.
Like,
well, everybody's got their style too, man.
Right.
Like, you know,
jazz
there's
drummers,
no wrong way to do anything, man. And that's the one thing I really had to learn is like,
yeah,
there's not a wrong way. If it works for you and you can play your piece or whether it's a, you know, a kit piece or a, like you're saying, concert snare drum or whatever,
yeah.
If you can play it
and sound good
and, you know, that's all that matters. You know, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Like, I had to learn that as well. It took me a long time to learn that.
Yeah, because I was actually taught open-handed.
Yeah.
You know,
I remember that.
Yeah, so I played left-hand, and our buddy Cody, he plays that way too.
Yeah, because he's like true left-handed.
He's a left-handed. Yeah, I'm a right-handed guy. I've always been right-handed, but I was taught to play open just so I could have versatility over the toms and stuff.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense if you think about
and
it.
And I loved it growing up, and I used to fight people like, yeah, that's I got more versatility, or, you know, like, that's why I do that. Like,
I learned what versatility means yesterday.
Yeah. So it was like, but, you know, about a year ago, I taught myself, I was like, I want both of my hands to play both sides just as well. And I, you know, everybody can play, if they're right-handed, they can play right-handed on the hi-hat, you know, if you're a drummer, you know, that's normal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if you've never played a kit, like you go to that, you know,
yeah,
because I mean?
You're seeing that,
right? You see that, and you're like, yeah, I'm right handed, boom, I'll sit down. That's, you know, it's the what does he call it? Industry standard,
yeah.
You know. So, but I was always the sore thumb playing left hand on the hi hat. And just recently, I remember I was like, man, like those hi hat chops in this reggae stuff, a lot of the, you know, like the, you know, a lot
fast
of
swing.
Yeah, the fast swing hits, you know, randomly in a straight pattern, or the diddles on one hand into holding straight eighth notes the whole time, you know. It's like, it's chops, man. So like, and I have the chops in my left, but I wanted to make sure I had them in both,
which
so
is one of our goals as drummers, is to be able to be almost ambidextrous and like have strengths in both hands the same
for sure. So I took over and I started playing right over, and it's just I started having playing a lot of shows.
Yeah.
Started having putting, you know, obviously the hi-hat rides higher.
Yeah.
So when I have that left hand on that hi-hat, I feel kind of hunched a little bit.
Yeah.
And my left shoulder started having problems, you know, again, back to with that energy and the adrenaline of the live show, I started banging. It just became more of like an arm movement and stuff. And I was just like, man, I'm really not liking this. So, and I haven't played live shows my whole life. You know, we've played marching stuff and I've played a few gigs growing up and stuff, but when Third Coast Roots got really heavy into playing shows, it was like, I got to find something more comfortable. And with that cross, you just feel...
I felt the exact same way.
You can relax your shoulders with your sticks, you know, crossed like that. As long as you... Obviously, everybody's got their own setup and stuff, but I figured it out, you know, and that's kind of what I'm working on now, is just building that right hand on the hi-hat and being able to... Because it kind of changes my fills a little bit, you know? Now
yeah,
my hands are placed different, you know?
The voicings are going to be different.
Right.
The orchestration is going to be different. And like... What you hear in your head is now going to switch between left-hand lead, right-hand lead,
right.
Or, you know, vice versa. So, like, did you find yourself lowering cymbals at all? Did you find yourself lowering the hi-hat? Or did you just kind of go with the same setup?
I raised the hi-hat.
Oh, okay.
Because I was playing, obviously, I was having shoulder problems, so I kept bringing that hi-hat lower and lower whenever I was on the left hand.
Mm-hmm.
And then I switched to the right, and it was like, all right, now my snare stick is, like, clashing with where my hi-hat's play. So I brought the hi-hat up, and I've always loved Travis Barker growing up. Like, the way he plays,
we
his hi-hats
did.
Are just way up here. And I was like, man, that's style right there. And, like...
He's got chops, man.
He's a good drummer. Yeah. Like, hands down.
I don't care
dude,
what anybody says. Yeah. Like, he's got speed. He's got sound quality.
Yeah.
And he's consistent.
He's controlled. He sounds great. And I mean, dude, like I said, dude's got style.
Yeah.
And nowadays, it's all that matters.
He kind of developed.
You know?
They went away from like thrash punk, where it was like Are you familiar with the drummer Joey Castillo?
Yeah.
He, you know how like he plays like that thrash punk, like
right.
Time is kind of like up in the air.
Right.
But he's still pretty solid on his end. Travis, when they went through like kind of going more alternative and everything like that, he stayed so consistent with his parts and like he stayed so consistent with like just kind of even after his accident. Like if you watch some of his older Instagram videos where he's doing like warm up and exercise stuff on pads, he's really relaxed. He's really like consistent all throughout the inner beats.
Yeah.
He's a solid, solid drummer that I don't think sometimes gets enough credit within the drum community. He gets right. a lot of credit otherwise.
Well, there's just so many Karens in the
it's in a the, good reference, yeah.
In the drum or in the music industry in general. So I mean, like I said, everybody's got this like, no, this is how you do it. No, this is how you do it. And it's yeah. like there's no wrong way to do it. Mm. The dude's successful as hell, killing it.
About
like,
as successful as you could be.
12-inch stick heights in every kit on every drum, no matter the placement, just full send. And that's appealing to me. As a kid and growing up, I was like, this dude's badass. Yeah. Like, this dude's G.
I mean,
and so like I started like, yeah, I'm gonna start banging the shit out of him. Like, yeah. You know, I started raising my cymbals up. Shout out Carlos from Tribal Seeds, because I saw that dude just like he played like kind of like this hunched over style, like rocking and swaying, and then he had his cymbals so high it was almost like he was just like uppercut,
yeah,
uppercut, and he would just like uppercut
in
the
your
cymbals.
Face kind
yeah
of thing.
And it was just it was aggressive, and like from the performance view it was just like, man, that's a show.
It is
like that's I could watch that, you know, and not need, you know what I mean, and I just started realizing like, man, this is a you're a performer.
You know, it's more than just the beats.
Yep.
Because like if we were talking about the non musician listener, right?
Right.
So you got non musician listeners within the crowd, whatever crowd you're playing in front of.
Right. They don't know what a paradiddle is.
No, they don't care.
Yeah.
Either.
Exactly.
And so like when you go to a show, you play a fill of dot dot do 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 do. They think that's awesome.
Yeah.
And to us, that's. We learned that in the first 2 weeks of playing drums, right?
Right.
But to make that sound good and make it consistent and do it and perform with it, that's the hard part. That's what a lot of people don't get.
Yep.
If I had your gig, I would have to put myself out there more visually and performance-wise because it's part of the gig.
Right.
So
it's like, definitely something you learn over time.
Yeah. And you adapt to what your crowd is, right?
Right.
So your crowd, like the audiences that you play for, which you're starting to play for bigger audiences, you're starting to play for bigger venues, what keeps them coming back and buying your music and buying your merch and listening to your streams and stuff like that or watching your live feed is the more than anything the visual aspect.
Right.
I mean, why do people go to EDM shows? The bass drops and the visual aspect. What's the DJ really doing? Not to crap on EDM, but like, what's the DJ really doing?
Press and play.
And he's jumping up and down. He's going like this. And there's a visual something going on behind him. So I really think it goes up to like 40% visual.
For sure.
Of the job.
Visual, I mean, it's definitely, I mean, just in all aspects of your image as a human. You know, it all matters, you know. Luckily we have a male female versatility in our style, and reggae music, that's not common. It's not common in any bands.
Right.
Honestly, in anywhere.
I can only think of two.
You know, exactly.
So
and there's a few in the reggae scene, yes. But they're kind of inactive or whatever. But you know, it's just that's such a appealing image. People want to see that, you know, they want to see not only, you know, your performance as, you know, a visual aspect, but they want to see you and like how you portray yourself and like, you know, whatever. And they want to get to know you and get to talk to you. And that's another thing with like building your fan base and stuff. So
yeah, you have to stand, you know, after the show, you know, you're tired. You just played an hour set. You've got a
load. It's a full-time job.
It is. And you got to stay back, and like people appreciate the time.
Right.
Of like just talking to them, like I think I told a story a couple episodes about this, but Aaron Gillespie, Under Oath drummer.
Okay.
I met him when he was doing solo stuff. Under Oath hadn't come back together yet, but I was such a huge Under Oath fan.
Right.
Like just huge.
I loved Under Oath.
loved it. And the, you know, They're Only Chasing Safety and Define the Great Line albums were like anthems to my childhood. And I met him and he was just such a jerk, man. And like, didn't care if anybody was talking to him.
Yeah.
And that was so disappointing to me because like, I found him to be such a role model.
Yeah.
And I found him to be an inspiration. And to have that happen, I was like, man, like, I think you're missing part of it.
Yeah.
Your
some
music
people just, it's not, they're just not, you know, they're players of their craft and that's it.
That's
and
it.
It doesn't go farther than that.
Yeah.
But one thing I've learned, man, is just be yourself and, you
be
know,
cool,
these people, you know, are here for you.
Yeah.
So, and they're here for the experience and the time, like, to make a lifetime memorable time for another human being, like, that's what we live for. So that's like what, you know, just be yourself, treat these people with respect. And, you know, I've heard tons of stories growing up about, you know, musicians being assholes and just not wanting to do autographs or, you know, meet and greets and stuff, you know, whatever. But
it's not even like it wasn't, I just wanted to talk to him.
For sure.
Or just
say, yo,
him.
I love it. Yeah. Like, you're drumming, everything growing up. Like, yeah.
I've always been weird about pictures with celebrities anyway, or not really celebrity, but like people of influence of me. And
sure.
I was like, I don't care about a picture. I don't care about an autograph or anything. I just want to say thanks. Happened to me with Dave Weckl too. Dave Weckl is such a huge inspiration. And my buddy and I were at NAMM and tried to talk to him. He was just not very personable. And it was like, man, you would think after like 35 years of being in the industry, of being at the top of the industry, the drum industry in particular, you would think, you know, hey, I'm going to be at this convention with 20,000 people. I should probably be a little bit more patient. You know? And it's unfortunate, but at the same time, I guess that's what separates people from being, you know, like people like Steve Gadd or like my true inspirations, like Vinny Caliuta or all these people or, you know, Thomas Lang. They're all great people. And I think, you know, I mean, let's talk about something that I'm not really familiar with because I've been out of town for so long, but how is the Houston live scene? So is it, would you say it's one of the better live scenes in the state? Would you say it needs work? What's your like opinion on that?
Yeah, I'd say the Houston live scene is great. Hang on one second.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the Houston live scene is great. There's tons of bands, all different styles. They do really well. Especially like in kind of our style, like, you know, like the ska, like there's a few ska bands that do pretty well, and it's definitely cool to see that. I think Austin also has a great scene, and Dallas has a great scene, as far as, you know, South Texas goes.
Right.
Yeah, we're just so, you know, I was telling you this earlier, it's just, we're just so far south, it's tough for these bands to make it, if you want to say, you know. It's, they got so far to travel and only so many cities in the 10 hour radius. You know, there's only so much you can do. So it's like you get to play in the markets over and over and over and over and over and over. And then you get that residency gig.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's like, is this really what we want to be doing right now? You know?
Mm-hmm.
So my band has had to kind of take some time out of playing shows to better benefit when we did play that show or shows.
That's an interesting point. I didn't even think about that.
We would take time off and, I mean, you know, people were fiending. They just wanted that show. I mean, kind of like right now, you know, like there's no live music. I mean, people are dying for a live show. So, you know, you gotta play smarter, not harder. And, you know, as much as we love playing, we'd play every day if we could, but it's not.
People get burnt out.
Yeah. I mean, it's just not, there's an algorithm to it and you can't mess that up.
It really is.
So
you
have to play smart because some moves can take your steps backwards. So,
yeah, I mean,
definitely have to be smart. But the scene is great. I mean, there's tons of bands and tons of versatility. I mean, I think Texas does have a good scene. I think
outside of country music.
Right. Oh, yeah. I guess, yeah. I mean, I'm not one to partake in country.
But, me either. But I'm just saying because, like, that obviously is, like, the biggest market here.
It's crazy. We actually opened up at Pasadena Rodeo. For,
did you really?
For what's his name? Kevin Fowler.
He's a Texas guy.
Yeah. We opened up for him at the convention center.
That's crazy.
And we were playing, you know, Babylon Burn music, reggae, crucial, you know, music. And he was playing at that yeehaw.
Did he say anything?
No, but I mean, we played to a, like, a, you know, versatility, you know what I mean? Like, we played to a bunch of faces that we'll never see at our show, you know what I mean? But yeah, we gained some fans, and that was kind of cool, you know?
Have to, like, take those risks, almost.
Right, yeah, and it was definitely, we were like, man, this could go really bad, or this could go good, or we just had to do it, you know?
Had to.
And obviously, it's a city gig, so they paid us, so, yeah, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's the main reason.
At the end of the day, if, you know, if you meet, you know, meet at least a couple of the good gig standards, yeah, you know, it's a good gig. I mean,
right,
you got some fan bases, it was probably a right, cool hang.
Sold some merch, yeah, made some money, and played some music and made some fans, so yeah, that's all what it's about, you know. But the Texas scene is good. It's just like I said, we're so far south.
I didn't even think about that.
But we do get spoiled. It's crazy on tours. Like, tours do come to Texas quite often. A lot of the tours will make sure they at least hit Texas once or twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they may not be every single time, or sometimes they'll do these, you know, Midwest runs and they'll leave Texas out just because of the travel time and stuff and mm-hmm, the budget. But overall, a lot of people do hit those markets, you know,
yeah,
down south.
Houston's like a huge city that some people yeah, don't want to miss out on.
Exactly. I mean, you know, the money you lose driving down here, you can make it back as if you play those cards, right?
Yeah.
So that's what it's all about. But yeah, man, the tours that, you know, we're involved in, they love Texas. They love coming to Texas. They love hitting, you know, us up. Hey, come open the show. We're coming to Texas, you know.
Warehouse, you know, Live,
et cetera. Yeah, Warehouse. Scout Bar,
White Oak,
House of Blues, White Oak, yeah, it's definitely been fun. But there's a scene, you know, it's good down here
for reggae specifically too.
Any genre, yeah. There's a reggae scene. I mean, it's very. I mean, there's a lot of bands, so I mean, it's definitely good to see, you know, a lot of people doing that and stuff. But our goal right now is kind of taking Texas off. At least pre-quarantine, that was the goal. It was like, you know, let's take some time off, let's work on the album, and yeah, let's get out there. We were
elsewhere.
Yeah, we were headed out on tour with Arise Roots. We were headed from Cali, Utah, New Mexico, Texas, Georgia, and Florida, and it was kind of like a country trek. Like, we're doing like kind of the whole, you know, east to west vibe.
Pond up in south, a van and just right, going. Yeah.
Yeah, we have a tour van, and it's kind of how we've been taking travel. And We've toured a few times. We've gone up to Colorado a few times and Cali, and this is our first time out east, so we were stoked. But
Florida has, I'm sure, has a huge scene.
Yeah, I mean, anything coastal is yep, great for reggae music. I mean, actually, people yep, love the water and, you know, the beach vibe, and that's kind of what we portray to. And like, I grew up listening to, besides the metal and stuff, but like, you know, the Jack Johnson and
yeah,
you know, the coastal style of music that was, you know, definitely had a place in my heart. And
it's present with all of us who grew up here.
Right. And, you know, that's kind of where the Third Coast comes from, is like, we are the Third Coast. Like, yeah, you got the, you know, East Coast and West Coast, and then you got the Gulf Coast, and it's the Third Coast. It never yeah, gets love and never gets, you know, talked about never, or anything.
We're so, not as pretty as the other coast. But,
yeah. I mean, but still, man, it's like that. Growing up around water and stuff Galveston. Is, yeah, I mean, Galveston, you know, even Sylvan and, you know, just,
all,
yeah, everything yeah, that's so close, just being around the water is definitely like, it's definitely embedded in you, you know, and that's something that we wanted to portray into the music and stuff. And just easy listening is the goal, you know, like, we want something that you don't have to think about, you know.
Something about like the upbeat reggae that,
yeah,
gink.
For sure,
it
yeah,
just, it just puts head people bobbing, at ease. Yeah,
yeah, it's just that head bob music that you just can't. It's I like to call it world music, because every ethnicity and human being, whether male or female, from ages 10 to, you know, 85, can listen to, you know, reggae music and
yeah,
you know, have a positive input on it, or, you know, whatever. So I think it's very world accepted, you know.
I would agree. It's very so, universal.
And
it's,
I've yeah, been, you know, pretty like, you know, big belief of like the whole philosophy and, you know, reggae music and just conscious music and just, you know, just conscious decisions and stuff like that. And so like, that's why reggae music is kind of, you know, the whole one love, especially with what's going on right now, you know, it's just,
yeah, it's awful.
One love, you know, it's the main goal. So it's definitely it's world acceptable, and that's kind of why we're trying to push the message and, you know, spread the vibe. But the main goal is just easy listening, and, you know, just don't have to think about it, because, I mean, we grew up playing metal, and it's like the more yeah, intricate the fill, the more cooler you were,
yeah,
you know, like the more points you get. But now, like you're saying, it's just that
playing the part.
Yeah, just play the pocket, man. that's one thing. Like when I switched from playing metal to like a lot of reggae, I would take my cymbals off completely.
That's smart.
I took all my cymbals off.
Yeah.
But the hi-hat. And I would do, and I would go to hit that crash. It wouldn't be there. Mm. And I'd be like, ooh, pocket. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, so it taught me to like not fill it, yeah. like, or to fill, you know,
yeah,
like just very tiny little fills, just subtle and tasteful without, you know, all this crash action and coming on the downbeat, you know, so.
Tat, you have to explore,
right.
explore that setup just as yeah. much as like you would explore it if you set up another cymbal or something like that.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. It took me a long time to learn how to play the part.
Right.
And playing in that, in my, you know, the band that I was part of, It took a lot for me to just be like, all right, well, what fill can I put here?
You right. know
what I'm saying? It wasn't really, to me, my goal became, how do I keep this groove consistent so the bass player doesn't, you know, get pissed? Or like,
right.
how do I make the song sound as solid as possible? And that's where my drumming really took off, because now you take, you have all the technique bass, you have the independence or whatever, and now you're learning how to play music as opposed to playing right. drums. How to be a part of the music. And reggae is a really good vehicle for that, because the vibe and the message that reggae brings is sometimes more of a priority than anything.
Right.
And you don't want to get in the way of that.
Right.
Really staying out of the way.
So it's a less is more vibe.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know,
just definitely less is more, because then it makes that part where you do a fill so much more special.
Yeah.
And so much more meaningful and stuff. And I'm still learning to this day, man. Like,
yeah.
I'm telling you, like, I listen to music so deeply that like I'm always experimenting and trying to figure things out, or you know, whatever. And especially like, you know, I'm taking the seat with the production on this new album with Third Coast Roots, and it's got me basically like looking at the number sheet, you know, or at the map. I'm like, you know, mathematically lining things up, you know what I mean? And it's like, okay, well that doesn't make sense because this is there, so let's pull that. You know, it's just such a different way to look at music production, or you know, just songwriting in general.
In general, yeah.
So it's like, it's definitely made me grow, and you know, it's been a new journey for sure. But I've always had the passion for it, and it's definitely, you know, it's been great so far. But it makes you look at music completely different, and almost makes listening to music less enjoyable sometimes, because you're so focused.
I was about to say, yeah.
Man, that snare sucks, or that kick is so heavy. Mm-hmm. You know, how did he get that kick so heavy? Or, you know, you just listen to music like it's an equation you have to solve. It's, you know,
like,
what I mean? It's like
all that meme with all the numbers, like around, yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, that's that low pass filter at 80 hertz. Like, you know, it's like,
I wonder what plugins they're using. Right. I need to find that out. And, you know, it's interesting because I used to think that my listening experience was ruined. I used to think that because I was classically trained in college, that my listening experience was ruined with pop music or with anything that wasn't difficult
raw
and complex.
Instrumentation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
like, oh, that's a computer simulating that,
yeah,
that
exactly.
melody. That's fake.
How can I respect the right. players if they, you know, and then I had to get over that because I was driving myself crazy.
Yeah.
Like, how am I going to listen to anything from this point on?
Right. Well, it's all art too.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like everybody can paint a picture, get the same result, but go different paths.
Exactly. So.
It's different, man.
And I was listening to a lot of jazz, a lot of complex jazz, and I found myself getting really, not bored, but I just like, I need something different. So I went back.
Right.
I went back to the home base. And part of it was going back to some metal. So part of it was going back to Breaking Benjamin's Phobia album.
Yeah.
Some of it was going back to Kanye West College Dropout. You know, I had to get out of it. And
yeah.
I was like, I want my listening experience back. Because
right.
at this point, you know, I just finished my master's degree. And my whole master's degree was 2 years. It was only a 2-year program. But my whole master's degree was working on my musicianship.
Right.
And in order to do that, you know, that's getting away from all the technique development. Everybody's always developing some kind of technique or whatever. But getting away from that as the priority and working on my musicianship and my listening, I had to go back.
Right.
To something that was easy listening or something that was complex, but now I had a greater understanding of, you know what I'm saying? So
for sure.
I think I got it back, which I'm happy for, because I didn't want to be that guy who just drove in the car in silence.
Right.
Because I had been listening to music all day or playing music all day, and I was just, I needed a break.
Right.
I wanted to get back to the point where I was craving it and still craving it, and which is, I mean, part of the reason why I started a podcast was because I wanted something, I wanted to be inspired again. So, and I mentioned this last episode, but
yeah, I respect that.
I also know a lot of people have a lot of cool stories and going down really cool paths. So, but because of the podcast and because of, you know, getting over, you know, and going back home to the music that I started listening to when I was younger, it's really helped me get that back. You know what I'm saying? And I'm thankful for that because some people just don't get it back. Some people are like, all right, next thing, next gig,
right,
whatever, and they drive home and
hiring. Yeah.
Exactly. They're a hired gun.
Yep.
If you haven't seen that documentary, it's really good too.
Okay.
It's like LA musicians who, they interview the guy who came in for Ozzy Osbourne, the guitarist who died in a plane crash. They interviewed the guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
They interviewed
I saw that, but I haven't seen the documentary.
Yeah.
I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, dude, it's good because they interview Kenny Aronoff, who...
Okay.
He drummed for like Smashing Pumpkins, right, all these kind of people, but he's known for learning songs like on the plane flight over to the studio.
Right. The day of.
Yeah, exactly. He's a hired gun. He's
session player. Yeah.
He figured the game out because in reality, playing music is kind of a game.
Yeah.
You achieve levels in your musicianship and your listening and your playing ability. And you eventually get to a point where you're like Ringo Starr or you're like Kenny Aronoff, or you're like all these people who are, they just do it.
Right.
They can just sit down and do it. And some people have, like, we're in the stages of developing our ear and production and developing production techniques and tricks. Yeah. And then we get to the point where it's just second nature.
Right.
Like with anything, you know?
Yeah, man. Yep.
I mean, like, you're using Pro Tools. So, like, when did you start, I guess, at this point, you've probably like figured out some stuff that by this point, you're like, okay, I know what sound I want. I know how to achieve that sound. Do you feel like you're pretty far along in that journey, or do you feel like you still got a long way to go?
I think everybody has their way of doing things and stuff, but, I started working in Logic on a buddy's MacBook that I was actually borrowing at the time because I had the more time. So like back to that whole, you know, getting in the band story, I actually quit my job cold turkey because I was like, if I'm gonna do this, I've got to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I quit working that job, and I think for about 6 months I was unemployed. Mm-hmm. And I was just every minute of the day doing everything I could to either learn or better myself at whatever was going on. And it was between the social media, the marketing, the logo creation, the merchandise, the everything, the full circle, man. And I started really getting into production and stuff. And I remember I produced a few tracks and I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I was just following, you know, all right, layer it with this. Okay, cool. Lay some keys, you know, just following the reggae regimen. I was, you know, the fat reggae bubble.
Yep.
And just, you know, making it big and heavy. And I started showing people and they were like, man, you did this? Like, I mean, I've had, you know, I actually, you know, on the low key, I had a really well-known producer in the reggae scene that I've never had the chance to work with or any of us have ever had the chance to work with. And he heard my mix and he was like, man, like, this sounds like you did this in your studio. You know, like, he was like, wow. And that's
which is
like,
huge.
Yeah, that's like, man, like, I can't tell you, like, I think it was like for 4 days straight, I was like, did this really happen? Like, did this guy really tell me this?
Those
like,
shock and awe moments that really push you forward.
And
too.
Then sent me a 30-minute voice memo of him like giving me tips and recommendations and stuff. And I'm just like, holy hell, like, I'm just some kid that really loves audio. And I'm a, you know, an audio nerd and just a song nerd and just started really diving into it. I mean, he's given me this encouragement, and that was like,
man, that pushed you really.
That was like,
the
man,
edge.
I'm doing something that's right. I may not be doing everything right, but I'm doing something that's right. You know?
I bet it validated your decision to quit your job. It validated a lot for you. Yeah.
And so, I had moved at the time, and then like I had got my new setup here, and I was like, man, you know, I really want to do this. And so I started a new company called Oracle Sound Studios, and basically, you know, we specialize in, you know, instrumentation, you know, audio engineering, the recording production, and the, you know, the mastering and mixing of the tracks. So, you know, I've been able to take my experiences and turn them into, you know, something that I'm passionate about and, you know, confident with, a product that I'm, you know, confident with releasing to the public. And, you know, I feel I can offer people something, you know, that they weren't expecting, or, you know, a better, you know, version of their product. So
yeah,
that's kind of what I've always wanted, to just help people out. And that's kind of where it's all kind of became like a, just like a passion for me, man. I spend all my money and time in audio production and stuff. And it's just, it's one of those things, man, you got to discipline yourself and just learn. And there's still so much I can learn, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's,
it's endless. Yeah.
Endless. I mean, people who are,
but you find your technique and like, you know, what works.
Yeah.
For you, everybody's got their own way, but as far as the end goal, like, I mean, there's no, you know, destination.
No, I mean, I find people who are dedicated to a craft are lifelong students.
Right.
So I'm always going to be a lifelong student of drums and percussion and audio, and it, and I'm totally fine with that.
Like, right.
I would rather be a student for a lifetime than a master of one thing.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? As far as drumming goes, like, there's just so much that, like, I'll sit down with the kid. I'm like, I need to work on that.
Yep.
Or I need to work on that.
Yep.
And it's like, I need to work on that.
I'm going to make a sandwich.
Yeah.
No, I need to work on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly. And you're like, I don't know when I'm going to use this, but I need to work on it. So when I do need to use it,
it's in my back pocket.
Yep. Exactly. It's like a tool bag.
Yeah, man.
And I find the same, you know, when I build my studio, in fact, we're recording this in his studio right now. You know, I feel like I'm going to have the same bug where it's like when I'm building all that up and I finally have all the gear that I could be finally a bassist now that I'm out of school, it's like, man, it's like I'm so close. I could taste. I've been saving all this money for such a long time. It's
right.
Like when you have a setup like you got here, which, you know, this is probably going to be the best sounding podcast I've ever had just because of the quality of the room and everything like that.
Yeah,
so
thanks, man.
Yeah, no problem. I mean, like, we mentioned, you know, I talked to you, I've been watching so many like YouTube setups of like
right.
people buying houses in Nashville so they can turn their studio into, or turn their home into a studio.
Right.
Like a wing of their home is like this complete customized, like they build off the wall, they insulate the whole thing, they drop clouds from the ceiling, they have high quality mics, they have clientele that they work for in Nashville, which is a hard market to work in.
Right.
And it's just super inspiring because, like, these people are, they're like, look, you can do all this with this level of gear and it's a good starter. And then once you build clientele, you can just upgrade from there. So, I mean, even on this, like, I was mentioning to somebody before, the quality of products at that lower level is becoming higher and higher. Like,
right.
you could really get a decent sounding mic for $400.
Oh yeah.
Like a
yeah.
Shure SM7B or something, like a vocal mic, you know what I'm saying? Like I really like where like our industry is going.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's definitely it's evolving. Technology is getting pretty crazy. I'm using this AKG 414 right now.
It's,
I mean, it's been a great mic so far. A lot of the vocals that we're tracking have been tracked on it. But I upgraded some hardware recently, and I got a package with Antelope Audio, and I actually got an emulation mic. And so what it is basically you record through the mic. The mic sounds great raw. I mean, it sounds great, but you have a plugin that's an emulator, and the changes the cardiograph of the microphone virtually. So you can change it between 80 different mics, but you record it once. So it's also post-recording. Like, you can record a vocal take and then scroll through all 80 mics and be like, oh, this one's drier.
What?
This one's wetter. Yeah, so I've
heard of this, though.
So that's what I've been tracking all the vocals for the new album with their Coast Roots is that emulation mic. And I've been able to, it's just a tiny little, you know, emulation mic about the size of this 414. And it's in my vocal booth right now. And Man, the quality, it's insane. I mean, I literally got it for free. It came with my package. But I want to say they go for $400.
Even then, 80 right. mics in one.
Yeah, I mean, it's 80 mics. I'm talking Tokyo 800T. Like, I mean, that's a $5,000 yeah. microphone, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, there's a bunch of, actually, I think it's more like 1600, but I jumped that one.
No,
but,
it's all good.
There's a few microphones that are just top of the line that it gives you as a selection, and it's like, I paid $400 and I can emulate this mic.
Dude, like, that's one thing I've gotten into as well, is like knowing standards and levels of microphones, especially in the drum community where like,
oh yeah,
like you can get away with buying the CAD set or something like that, but you really got to do a lot post production wise.
Yeah, that's my, I'm about to make a pretty big purchase actually. That's my next purchase.
You going with
drum mics?
You going with Earthworks?
No, I'm doing a blend actually, doing some other, some blends and stuff, but a lot of Shure stuff.
Yeah. Can't go wrong.
Yeah. I'm getting some nice stuff, but they're expensive. So, and yeah. I don't want to buy used. So that's the next goal, is to start tracking drums right here in this room. So, I mean, it sounds great right now, but you know, once I get those mics and get some room mic set up, it'll be golden.
I would love to excited. Help you with that if you need help. Cause I nerd out about that kind of stuff. I'm swearing it keeps me on YouTube like for hours.
Yeah.
I'm just like, I got to know how this guy got this sound or whatever.
No, for sure. Yeah, I'll show you some drum bounces later.
Yeah.
Hanging out, I'll show you some drum bounces that we've pulled off, and just the qualities definitely. I mean, yeah. I've been very stoked on it, so.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's definitely new. It's new for me. It's a learning curve, so. I've always worked with an engineer that, you know, engineered the actual recordings.
Yeah.
Pre, you know, recording. So doing it myself is definitely different. And I've got the help of Mikey right now. He's used to play guitar for us in the band, but he's had his own little home setup, and he's been kind of helping me engineer the drum recordings and stuff. So
yeah, we talked about it before. I can remember his name. Where did you record the first album?
So we went to Ian Young's studio. Ian Young is, he's a producer. He used to play keyboards in Tribal Seeds. Mm-hmm. And he has a studio called Imperial Sound Studios. And we packed our bag, booked a flight to Cali, and spent 7 days or 5 days in his studio, Monday through Friday, 8 hours a day. And we came up with Not Afraid, which is our debut album. It's available on Spotify. I mean, anywhere you stream music or purchase music, it's available. So go check it out if you haven't, for anyone that's listening. The album was a great, I mean, learning process in general. We tracked live. So we did everything live instead of like, hey, all right, everything's tracked. Now you're going to go lay the drums. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like we all played at the same time.
I love that.
It was all tracked and we were all in the booth and like, you know, I was in the drum hall and then like Jayton's in the vocal booth. Marissa's in the vocal booth. He's playing guitar. That's, you know, quarter inch line into the interface in the vocal booth. So it was just like, it was natural, you know what I mean?
I love that because it makes it more organic.
Yeah, it was definitely an organic album. Now we're able to like kind of dissect things and redo and retake or punch in and fix errors and stuff. And we want to make the best product, you know, that's mm-hmm. the main goal.
It's the way to do it.
It's professionalism just... and it's all the big wigs. That's how they do it, man. It's just, you know.
Part of the industry, but it ends up being a great product. I mean, as far as like... the industry standard for reggae sound, who is like at the top right now?
Man, I have to say like right now today, like as far as like the momentum, like that has gained the most success the fastest, I'd have to say Stick Figure.
I've heard of them.
They're based out of, I want to say San Diego. Man, Scott Woodruff and Stick Figure. I mean, he is like, it's crazy, man. He's capitalized on the whole reggae scene. He has this like Woodstock vibe with the stuff that he does. And it's just like, it's kind of like Woodstock, you know, where you saw millions of people like trodden that way. It's just, you know, that's how fast people are coming to him and like his sound and his style. And I mean, he sold out Red Rocks the day they dropped that they were doing a show at Red Rocks.
You got to wait
80,000 people.
You got to wait a long time to play that venue too.
Like, are you kidding me? Like he sold that thing out, and now they have an annual thing where they do it, I'm pretty sure, every year.
That's hard to do.
So, I mean, these guys, they're killing it. They went to freaking Europe and did sold out shows with a band called Dub Inc. They're from France, and they sold out like 7 shows in like amphitheaters in Europe for their first time overseas. They're crushing it right now. But I give hats off to like Slightly Stupid, Revolution, Tribal Seeds. I mean, those guys have been killing it for years now. Iration.
Soja.
Soja. They're doing great. They do good overseas too. South America, Brazil, stuff. They do great.
Their drummer's great.
Yeah. I mean, dude, that guy's awesome. Super underrated. He's a funny guy too. On Instagram, he makes like these like meme videos. I don't follow him. Yeah, he's funny. I'll have to show you his thing.
But when I was playing in that reggae band, they would reference him a lot. Yeah. They're like, yeah, dude, he's got to be one of the better reggae drummers out there.
Yeah, he is. He is. Like, hats off to him. He's one of my favorite reggae drummers. Zeb, he's got that pocket style. He plays drums for Tribal Seeds right now, one of my favorite reggae drummers. Also, shout out Tanner from Ayaterra.
Mm-hmm.
He's their newer drummer. He's fucking killing it.
Murder.
His style, I mean, he just reminds me of Travis Barker with his, like...
Yeah.
His aggression, and just check out some stuff from Ayaterra's
recent, I definitely will. I'm going to go down a rabbit hole. Yeah.
His stuff is great, man. He plays like a beast. Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of big bands that I look up to right now. I've been, honestly, like a main goal that we've been going through recently is trying to pull influence from different scenes. So I've actually, you know, like listened to a lot of Bruno Mars and Anderson .Paak and Wolfpack, and you know, just really trying to branch out and listen to other stuff to pull like this different twist on things. Like I get effects from these other genres. Like, oh, damn, that's a cool effect. Like he pulled that snare and it panned left and right and was like phasered out. Like, you know, so just stuff like that really inspires me. And I try not to just listen to reggae. You know, I still listen to a lot of metal. I listen to a lot of emo music.
Yeah.
I listen to, you know, all sorts of music from trap rap to, you know,
Houston rap.
Yeah. Just, you know, alternative to just indie style and, you know, Jack Johnson, Donovan Frankenreiter, you know, stuff like that.
That goes into your musical DNA, which comes out through your playing and through your production.
Right. And I go through phases where I listen to some things more for a few months or, you know, et cetera. But overall, like I listen to such a wide variety of music, or like I won't visit this one genre for a while and then I'll visit it and be like, man, I miss this. You know, just like music that's timeless. And it's just like, you know, an album that like you remember, like it puts imagery in your, you know what I'm saying? Like you remember, like I remember when I first listened to this song and I was like in the car with this guy or, you know, whatever. Like, so it's
that was like me with, you know, when, like I mentioned, going back, I was like, man, I remembered driving to work and listening
it's
to this
like
album.
Deja vu, man. It's weird. It like is. The music has such a crazy impact on us, like in our brain. It's insane. And that's why I respect it so much, you know, like it's.
And you want to honor it by perfecting your craft.
Right.
And a lot of people don't get that. We talked about people who kind of just do it for fun.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that. But like, there's something about if you're trying to make a career out of it, that you want to respect it in a certain aspect.
Yeah, and for sure.
For that is the intention behind it. Right. So. Sure. Every rehearsal you're going to take professionally and seriously.
Yep.
Every gig you're going to take professionally and seriously, and you're going to make sure you put the best product out there through your albums, through your live performances. So,
and that's what we've been, man, I'm telling you, just dissecting it, just making sure we have like the most optimal product that we can make. And, you know, we're actually working on a full length album right now, all recorded here at Oracle Sound Studios. And I'm super stoked to share it. I mean, it's a process, so I mean, it takes time. You know, we've been on a decent break right now while we're wrapping some things up, but I couldn't be more stoked with the way things are going, and I'm very excited to check it out. But if you're listening, if you haven't heard any of our music, check it out on Spotify or wherever you stream music, just at Third Coast Roots, and also go follow on Instagram or Facebook.
Yeah.
So
the. Our podcast, well, my podcast is available on Spotify now, so that is really, really helpful because a lot of people use Spotify.
Yep.
I was just relying on SoundCloud and Apple Podcasts for a long time. So, I mean, one last question, I guess, is that is the group, you're truly independent, right? Or do you sign it? Yeah.
We're completely independent. I mean, we own all of our music and... You know, we work with distribution deals to, you know, get our music out, you know, but everybody has to do that to, you know, release music and stuff. So there's different ways of going about it. And but yeah, we're independent artists right now. We're all, I mean, I'll tell you right now, I have not made $1 being in this band. Mm-hmm. Every dollar that we make goes right back in to the band. and we fund the band it by itself now with the money that we make, and we dedicate our work and, you know, our jobs and our income to put aside the money to make sure we have that to go on tour, and we have that to go play this game. We have the gas money and the food money and the money to pay the hotel and, you know, all that.
Until
we're making a salary, yeah. You know, so it's at the point where, you know, we're devoting all of our time and money and everything into it just so it's self-sufficient, you know, yeah. That's the goal.
It's a risk, but it's worth it.
It's a big risk, man. It's a huge risk. I can't even go down that path of how big of a risk it is, you know, especially in a scene like reggae music where it's kind of underground and not the biggest genre there is today. You know, it's not got a huge fan base, you right. know. It's not like, you know, pop, you know, so, but it's just something we believe in. So we're just sticking with it and just pushing, man. So
a lot of people don't really talk about the financial aspect of like a career yeah. like that.
They're... Man, being in a band, it's expensive and it's tough because, like, you know, back to what we're saying about the markets being saturated, these venues are like, oh, well, why would I put you on the show when you want $1,000? I got Joe down the street or Bobby down the street.
$350,
he'll play for $100, you know? And he's bringing his own shit, you know, whatever. So it's like, you know, you got to battle that sometimes. So that's why when we tour, we normally work with the headlining act if we're opening shows, and we get them to take care of hospitality and stuff because, you know, the band will recognize the hustle more than the venue. And so when the band takes over, they take that out of their total budget for the night.
Yeah.
And then that pays you, you know, instead of you having to work with the venue indirectly or whatever. So
the business side of it, man, it's so crucial.
Yeah, man, it's crazy. I mean, just running the website and, like, you know, me and Jayton do a lot of the footwork behind the scenes as far as the technical stuff, like, you know, emails and website and merch orders and shipping and tax and, you know, taxes and just it's tons of work, man. And then now I've got my own business, Oracle Sound Studios, and it's like the taxes with that and just like the LLC and all the legal paperwork and you know, you just got to play your cards right, man. But it's all worth it, man, because the end goal is just to work for yourself and not work for somebody else. So
you got to grind. Yep. And so, but at the same time, it's something you love to do.
Yep.
And do you have socials and websites for both Oracle and Third Coast?
Yeah. So it's just at Oracle Sound Studios and at Third Coast Roots. And Third Coast Roots is spelled THRD Coast Roots.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we're anywhere you can find it. So, I mean, definitely check it out if you haven't. I mean, if you like what you hear, give it a share and, definitely subscribe to the podcast on Spotify. I don't know. Can you follow, the podcast?
Yeah. Follow it. And
follow the podcast and share it and let's get these plays up and, you know,
it helps both of us. But at the same time, you know, I wanted to bring you on cause you know, we've been buddies for a while and, know each other relatively well. And, I'll put links to everything in the description as well. That way people can just click and go.
Perfect.
One thing that I like to do at the end of each episode is just ask people, like, what do you listen to? Like, what's your Spotify look like right now? Like,
oh man,
outside of the stuff you're producing.
Yeah. Let's see. I'm gonna pull it
up. Yeah. I love when people just pull it up. Cause like, it's right there and they're like, man, I've been listening to that.
It's pretty crazy. The other day I was doing like a live stream drum, thing where I you know streamed the audio from the Spotify and then like obviously like my drums and I was just jamming out and I was playing a lot of reggae music and I knew all the songs. I was like, man, this is cool, like, but I didn't know, like, you know, the structure of the song. I was just kind of vibing, you know.
Yeah.
And then like Britney Spears pops on and I'm like, what is it, my daily mix? So like someone must have listened to Britney Spears, probably Marissa. Yeah. But you know, I was like, what the hell is all live stream? I'm just like jamming out to Britney Spears. But, yeah, I mean, right here, I'm looking at, recently played, we got the Rudimental podcast.
Yeah.
I got an emo playlist with stuff like, I mean, All Time Low, Taking Back Sunday, Hawthorne Heights. I worked out to that this morning.
Nice.
I have some Anderson .Paak.
He's awesome.
Yeah. I've got The Movement. Shout out The Movement. They're a great band. I mean, reggae or not, man, they're just great music. Check out The Movement.
Okay.
And I've got this daily mix going right here with, I mean, it's a bunch of roots music, Mortimer, you know, Samurai Eye, Lion Heights, Kanakaman, Anthony B, you know, just some heavy roots stuff. There's definitely some metal up in here too, and some rap.
What kind of metal?
Let's see. I'm looking at some Devil Wears Prada, Attack Attack, Abandon All Ships, Lamb of God. Lamb of God's like my favorite classic band.
Yep.
I mean, their music is timeless. Like that shit is so cool to me. I love Lamb of God so much. Their drummer is so good.
Yep.
I Wrestled Adler, a Bear once. Stuff like that, man. Like,
yeah.
Just a bunch of thrash metal. I work out to a lot of metal, and when I'm feeling hype, I listen to a lot of metal. Damian Marley. I listen to a lot of the Marley, Julian Marley, Damian Marley, and Stephen Marley. I've been checking out this new artist, Kez Namdi. It's Kezn-Amdi. And he's got his own sound. It's definitely reggae. It's roots reggae. But he's got his own sound, and he's not a Marley, but he sounds like a Marley, like his vibe. And I'm digging it for sure.
I'll check that out myself. I think I'm going to listen to a lot of reggae after this
episode. Man, it's great music. You know, I love sharing my playlist with people. So, I mean, I'll share it with you if you want. A lot of people I'll share it with, and then, like, that's all they listen to. It's so crazy, man. But there's also this Flamingosis. I don't know if you ever heard of them.
No.
I mean, they have this track called Sunset Park. And when I heard that, I was like, man, this is a vibe.
Yeah. It's like I'm in LA.
I was like, okay.
Yeah.
So I try to listen to stuff that's more different. So I have a different, you know.
Exactly. Oh, it's super different. Yeah.
But it's just like chill music. So, yeah. I mean, I listen to a bunch of stuff. Man, I could go on and on. Bunch of crazy stuff on my playlist.
Dude, I mean, that's the beauty of modern streaming and modern accessibility.
Yeah, but man, it hurts us artists.
Yeah.
I'll say that. I mean, the music industry's changed so much. I mean, you don't have Walmart and Target buying, you know,
albums.
Thousands of copies of your album, you know. I mean, now if you sell an album, that's gold right there. I mean, that's a lot of profit compared to what you make streaming. I mean, someone listened to your song 100,000 times and you make $10. You know what I mean? It's crazy.
Or like playing live is pretty much the main income now, especially for bigger artists. Like,
for sure.
Bigger artists obviously are going to get paid out.
It's merchandise and live shows.
Exactly.
Touring is the way bands are making money right now, because on streams, like, I think it comes out to like 0.006 cents per stream.
Yeah.
So that's like insane. You got to listen to that song so many times. But I want to say our debut album just hit 100,000 streams on Spotify.
Okay, good.
So that's like a big mark for us. It's been released for almost 2 years now, coming up this summer. And so 50,000 streams a year, 100,000 2 years. I mean, I'm stoked on that. So,
well, I was going to tell my listeners to just go and support them, and because they're a great group. Hunter's a great guy. That everybody behind the scenes of music with intent, like, I feel like it's gonna work itself out,
right?
And I think it's just patience and just continue to work hard.
Yeah, man.
Yeah,
that's kind of why I'm here, man. I just I wanted to take this opportunity to be on your podcast, you know, show support in your end and spread some knowledge on what's going on and just talk about a few things. And you know, I listen to podcasts myself, so I thought it was a cool idea. Let's do it.
Yeah, man.
But yeah, man, here we are, just following our dreams. So
yeah, dude, I mean, thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it. It's always an honor for people to like just take time and do it.
For sure.
And go follow Third Coast Roots. Keep up with their stuff, buy their merch, same with Oracle Sound Studios. Look into, if you have an inquiry about, you know, recording or getting a project done, hit Hunter up. I'm definitely going to do as much as I can to spread the word out for both of those things. So
yeah,
man, that's it for this one. We'll see you next time.
Peace.